All right, everybody, welcome back and thanks for joining us on the Unknown Strength podcast, where we aim to provide you with insights into the fight game and strength and conditioning training that translates into optimal performance in the cage, the ring, or on the mat. I'm your host, McGregor McNair, and joining me are my co-hosts, Brenton McKitterick and Steve Phillips. Now, this is part two of the Luke Lehman and Zoe Knight podcast, who are the strength and health optimization gurus behind MuscleNerds.net.
So if you missed part one of the interview, definitely go back and listen to that from the start. Luke Lehman is one of the foremost experts on health hormone and general performance, and his partner Zoe is the managing director of the company and also a goldmine of information.
And if you're a fighter or in the fight sports whatsoever, definitely listen to this interview in its entirety, because there's so much valuable information that just about everyone in the fight game can benefit from.
Yeah, absolutely.
So without further ado, here is the interview.
The sport of jiu-jitsu is incredibly grip-orientated, particularly with the gi, even judo, so it's something you'd have a lot of experience with. And you know that the hands take an absolute beating, so it's a fairly accepted reality, but by the time you get to black belt, you pretty much need to forgo any aspirations of being a hand model. So something that I find that sometimes my grip is the first thing to go on a strength session, having been so heavily utilized in my jiu-jitsu training. I feel like my hands become the weak point, my hands are so burned out, and when it comes to doing, I guess, the higher volume exercises, like deadlifts sometimes, I feel like my back, my hips, my legs, my entire posterior chain could pull, could pull a serious weight, but then I find that my hand just gripping it is a challenge. So do you have any suggestions or perhaps adaptations to the training, to get value or, get a result out of that?
Yeah, if you want to train your hands, you got to train your hands. So some of the things we'll typically use are things like belt or gi pull-ups, right? So we'll do that. We also do ironmind.com. www.ironmind.com has a ton of grip stuff. And I used to be really big into the grip things and bending horseshoes and nails and tearing phone books and all that type of stuff. But if you want an adaptation to your hand, you have to train your hands, right? And a lot of the guys will get pretty gnarly hands. Our friend Leo over at the Irish Strength Institute, and rolled with him just a little bit last time we were in Ireland, and the guy, I outweigh the guy by probably 30 kilos. He just completely fucking humiliated me. His hands, when he grabbed me, I thought I was going to shit my pants because I thought he was going to break my bones. And you would grab him, and he's so explosive and so strong. It's like wrestling a piece of metal, but doing things like the specific hand things, like actually working your finger grip. So Ironmind has a thing called Eagle, I think it's called Eagle Claw or Eagle Grip, and you can hang that from a bar and you can do pull-ups with that, and it causes you to actually work your fingers, not just your crushing grip. So that also, keep in mind that you have muscles on the back side of your hand as well that never gets worked. So what I used to do is I would get go buy a package of rubber bands, and I would put the rubber bands around my fingertips and I'd extend my hands. And what that would do is it saves a lot of trouble with things like getting golfer's elbow.
Kind of like an agonist-antagonist type movement.
Exactly. Same thing as we said with the boxers. If you don't have a really good upper back and really good external rotators and really good scapula, it's going to inhibit your ability to throw a punch really, really hard. So same thing with your hands. You need to make sure you're working that antagonistic, and you need to be working things for time. Like, if you're going to do like the grip strength you need for a deadlift or like a bar hang is going to be different than when you're actually using your fingers to hold on to a gi. So doing hangs, but hang on to your gi, taking a belt and cutting it in half and wrapping it around a bar and doing your deadlifts by holding on to the belt instead, or straps instead of holding on to the actual bar.
Go rock climbing.
I actually went rock climbing about a month ago, and I found that at the end of the week, after doing jiu-jitsu all week, my fingers are just that shot that I could definitely persevere through the pain, but it's something that I guess requires delicate balance. So
everything though, like if you don't use it, if it's gonna fatigue and get sore.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
You know what I mean, like the more you use it, the more you become, what's the word I'm looking for? Like accustomed to it.
Yeah. And how many people will work their fingers, but they don't stretch the fingers back out? So at them, they look like they have little lobster hands because they're always flexed instead of relaxed.
Yeah, you're gonna balance them out.
Yeah, I mean, we had our first climbing experience in London with the guys at We Move magazine. Yeah, man, these guys were like goddamn monkeys. They were just doing these ridiculous jumps from one platform to another, and Zoe and I were just trying to manage the first fucking level.
Oh, man, yeah, our fingers are gone after that.
Oh, you see them pretty much launch or catapult themselves from one little grip to another just off their pinky.
Yeah.
So let me just change directions here for a minute. Luke, last year, I think both you and Zoe spent some time with Stephen Howarth at Turning Point Strength and Conditioning in Albuquerque, New Mexico. For those who don't know, Stephen's been strength and conditioning coach to some of the biggest stars out of the Jackson Wink camp, including, John Jones, Holly Holm, and people like that. Can you just share with us some of your key takeaways from your time with Stephen, please?
Man, Steven's a champ. I've known Steven a long time. I was actually his coach for some physique stuff. So, and the guy has actually a really incredible physique once he polishes it down for a show. He's he's a super positive guy. He's created a really good culture at his gym. And what I really like is that he treats all of his clients like they're pro athletes. Like, not that he trains them like that, but they're all superstars. You know, it doesn't matter if it's Mary from next door or if it's John Jones, he treats everybody the same, which is something you don't normally find in facilities like that. But I tell you, the number one takeaway, he put us on his Wingate bike, and my number one takeaway is I don't ever want to do another fucking Wingate sprint ever again in my life.
I saw that video. That was hilarious.
Oh, my God. I actually got off the machine and my legs were slapping together. And
they burn for like 20 minutes afterwards. You're like, why won't they stop burning?
I can't decide what's worse, the Wingate bike sprints or like Aerodyne or Aerosol Tabatas. Both of them are equally fucking awful.
What I liked about Stephen, though, is his knowledge is undeniable. It's what Luke teaches a lot in his courses is that you always have to have a why. So whenever you write any program or you suggest any nutritional protocols or supplementations or anything, there needs to be a really clear, definite why as to why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And his why is there in every single aspect of everything he does.
He can tell you exactly every single dot of the I and cross of the T why it's in their program and what it's doing all the way from 16 weeks out to fight day. So he's got some really good protocols he uses. I don't really know them. You'd have to call him and interview him for this, but he uses with a Kaiser of how he produces power and how he measures the power, whether it's getting better or not and all that stuff. So it's really, really good stuff.
And discrepancies between left and right sides and all that sort of stuff.
Making sure they're balanced.
He's very, very smart and a really nice guy. That's my biggest takeaway. I liked him.
He's got some really good stories about some of the fighters and what they've done in the gym. So
speaking of fighters, we've seen Conor McGregor doing some movement work with Ido Portal during the last year or so. And as I understand it, you've had some experience with Christopher Summers from Gymnastic Bodies in the movement field. So what are your thoughts on the movement culture and how that can apply to fight sports?
Oh, man, I think it's great. I think the movement stuff is crazy good. It's, I've done... Zoe and I went and did the Gymnastic Bodies seminar, and that was both awesome and completely exhausting and brutal, but we learned a lot. And I've been a big fan of Coach Sommer since he first put out his Building the Gymnastic Body article on TMAG, which was, goddamn, that had to be like 12 years ago or something. And I also did a seminar with him when he came to Poliquin Group, and Coach Sommer's he's just a really great guy and so much knowledge. Him and his right hand man O-Wrench, their whole team is just really, like, they're just champs, man. We've done that. We use a lot of that stuff mixed in with our own traditional barbell dumbbell work. And my buddy Mike Fitch, who owns Animal Flow and Global Bodyweight Training, I've done Animal Flow 1 and 2, and that's freaking incredible. And I think a lot of this is, you have a lot of people that don't have a problem going in and squatting, and they go and they squat 250 kilos. They can't fucking crawl around on the ground without getting winded. And I think that's kind of pathetic. And that's where I found myself. I was actually at Zach Trowbridge's place in Chicago, all strength training. And I put on 365 pounds on the bar and was bench pressing. And I said, oh, I'm going to see if I can do some push-ups. And I actually got on the ground, did some push-ups, stood up and went, fuck, I would rather throw three or four plates on each side of the bench and bench press than actually do a push-up. And at that point, I was like, okay, this is ridiculous. Like, movement is one of the first things that goes when you get older. Like, strength is fairly easy to gain. It's fairly simple for me to put – I've put 150 pounds on people's all their major lifts in less than 9 months. That's fairly easy. What really goes is that mobility and that ability to
– touch your toes.
To touch your toes, yeah. And to basically master your vessel. And that's a thing. Like, doing a 250-kilo squat is fairly simple if you just follow the plan. But – it's not that easy to get on the ground and get inverted in a handstand or to crawl around and not be completely exhausted.
Yeah, it's also a very different skill set.
Yeah, with a lot of the movements that are done in the gym, they're really structured. So you're limited in your movement that you're able to do within that movement. If I've said this so many times, if that makes sense. But I think one of the biggest takeaways from when we done the Gymnastic Bodies Level 1, I think we were in London when we did that, weren't we?
No, that was Animal Flow.
Oh, that was Animal Flow. Yeah, Animal Flow. Sydney, yeah, sorry, left. Animal Flow Level, yeah, Level 1, was that you have a body, it's all you have, and you cannot control it. Like, you don't have strength in movements where you should. Like, we're designed to be a little more fluid than we are in our lifestyle. And it's so important to try and keep as much of it as you can, because like Luke says, it's the first thing to go. And what's the point in being able to deadlift 700 pounds if you can't even crawl on the floor with your child? Like,
yeah, and
what's
the point of that? And after being a competitive powerlifter for a long time, and I, you know, at one point I was, you know, I was deadlifting 340 or so, and I was squatting over 300, and, you know, that was all cool, but I just felt like shit. I couldn't move. And I know guys that can barely wipe their own ass.
I was just about to say that.
But they're so bound up, they literally can't reach back. They have to wipe between their legs like a in a pee.
Yeah.
And you know they got to have doo-doo up on their balls from that, right? No man should be wiping between his legs. That's something wrong with that. But I know guys that they strut around like a fucking peacock around the monolith, and they're so fucking strong, and they're so alpha macho bullshit, and you can't even wipe your own ass.
They're like T-Rexes.
They are. Yeah. They're on fucking shoes. So for me, I finally got to a point where I was like, okay, I've been the biggest guy in the gym. I've been the strongest guy in some gyms. I don't need that shit anymore. What I care about now is feeling amazing and doing a fucking cartwheel. I can do a fucking cartwheel, and it looks awesome. And and I'm really proud of it because I work really hard. And that, for a lot of people, sounds so ridiculous, but – how many fucking gym meatheads do you know that can't do a goddamn cartwheel?
Yeah.
It's so easy to get caught by our ability to move external objects, and we never really focus on internal objects moving ourselves.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And when you look at Connor, you look at his movement since he started doing that, and, you know, I'm giving the majority of his success, it always has to go with his fight camp and has to go with John Connor and all those guys. But it's undeniable when you watch him fight the fight. The more he does the movement stuff, the more crisp he gets. And now, I mean, look at his last fight. He barely gets touched. His ability to counterpunch, the guys barely miss him. His rhythm and his timing is so good now. When somebody swings, they whiff by millimeters, and he's on them.
Yeah, he definitely flows seamlessly, and that's always something really important as a fighter, to be able to transition between various techniques and make them connect really well and gel. And it's all about, I guess, the right technique at the right time. And I mean, as you highlighted, being able to have the movement capabilities to, you know, express that is absolutely paramount.
Absolutely, and you know, and to be able to do it and not waste any energy, right? And to be able to last five rounds.
Yeah,
so smooth as fast. So just out of interest, who are some of the other fighters that you'd watch in the UFC these days?
You know, honestly, we don't watch that much. I really don't know that many of the
Who's
fighters.
Who's the guy that just recently won that was a real show pony?
The real show,
you
what's
really
his name?
Liked oh, him.
I really liked him. I cannot remember his name,
I
though.
Would have said Connor, but we've already
mentioned
him.
Yeah, I've been a big fan of Connor's for a few years now. I remember seeing him fight in Boston. I was living near Boston, and John Connor got me a ticket, and I was able to go and watch it. And and he just steamrolled past the guy he was fighting. So I used to be hard out in it, man. Back in the day, I still have VHS tapes of when it first came out, and there were no fucking weight classes.
So do I.
They were just, and I was trying to talk to Zoe about it, like, because she's kind of got into this stuff recently, and I'm like, no, it was mania back then, because you would have a 185-pound guy fighting a 660-pound sumo wrestler.
That's right. UFC 1.
UFC 1. I've got the video. Yeah.
Taylor Tooley lost his teeth to Gerard Gourdeau.
Yeah, the UFC was brutal in the early days. Far too brutal.
It's like fucking Kumite blood sport shit, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Is that the guy? Which
one? I don't even know how to say
Garbrandt?
Cody Garbrandt, yeah.
Yeah, that guy.
No love.
I fucking love that guy.
Why? You love his tats?
His what?
His tats.
I like...
You watched him fight Cruz, I think it was.
I don't like the showboating, but I do like the counterpunching and the rhythm and the timing and the crispness and the power.
Footwork. You were really impressed with
the footwork, man. I've got a buddy... my buddy Rob Pilger in Ohio, he was a Golden Gloves boxer. Now he owns a really, really nice training center. And, he was telling me, I saw him post on Facebook once. He goes, if you walk into a boxing place and they start teaching you how to punch before they teach you footwork, leave. So ever since he said that, I'm always watching people's footwork, and his footwork and his timing was just fucking ridiculous.
Absolutely. That's where the power is generated, and that's what transfers through the body.
And that's the thing. Like, I'm just a big fucking ogre. Like, when I get into fights, I just grab them, put them on the ground, lay on top of them. So that's my special gift.
Nothing wrong with that strategy.
No, it keeps me from getting punched in the face, which I don't really care for too much. But like, to watch some of these guys and the complete power and control they have is just phenomenal. And I think a lot of the Joel Jamison stuff is gold as well. Teaching people that some aerobics is necessary, that the aerobic system buffers the anaerobic system, and that the anaerobic system is really there to take over when the aerobic system cannot make energy fast enough. If you keep that perspective on things, it gives you the knowledge of why it's so important to make yourself a wide aerobic base and then build your anaerobic stuff on top, and why you need to have some power endurance, because you need to be able to punch over and over and over without getting fatigued.
Interesting. I've just got a question about that. I hear all the time, a lot of people, I got a lot of friends who say, oh yeah, I really want to do jiu-jitsu, but I think I just need to get fit first. I just need to do a few things, and I don't want to come out of shape. And I always say, well, it doesn't matter how fit you are. When you start jiu-jitsu, everyone's going to maul you, and everyone's going to take away your energy reserve. So, I mean, something you touched on then, I guess, does that apply to actually weightlifting, do you think? Or in terms of anaerobic exercise, as you said, you've got to build that aerobic foundation.
Yeah, it can. There are techniques you can do, and look, if somebody thinks that they're going to be able to prepare themselves for jiu-jitsu, they're out of their mind. I thought the same thing, and within the first 45 seconds, I was in the bathroom puking my guts out. So there's just nothing that you can't. There's nothing you can do to prepare you, but there's things that you can do once you get used to it that can make you a better fighter. And some of the things, like, I like Joel Jamison's HICT training. Which you can do in a localized manner. So say like an upper body ergometer, where you would crank the intensity up so high where you have to really grind against it, and the machine's only moving at, say, 20-25 RPMs. Or single strokes. And you do that straight for 10 minutes, and what it does is it teaches your fast twitch fibers to be more oxidative, so that you can have repeated bouts of punching or repeated bouts of grappling without building too much lactate and without losing fatigue. So,
and it simulates a fight more in that respect as well, and more bursts of energy as opposed to sort of sustained application of force.
Exactly. And, when you look at conditioning, you have to look at systemic conditioning, which would be your cardiovascular system, right? So what adaptations are you trying to create in the heart? So what's the number one thing you need to create more fuel? Is you need oxygen. What do you run out of when you get when you fight? You start running out of oxygen. So building things like left ventricular size, building things like better vascular networks, increasing nitric oxide, things like that, you do systemically with generalized conditioning. But then you also have local conditioning, where you can target train those specific muscle fibers in your extremities by doing things like upper or lower body ergometers and certain strength training movements. But you really need something too, in my opinion, that's very concentric versus eccentric orientated, right? So making sure that you don't want a lot of eccentric work when you're doing your conditioning, because the eccentric work is what causes a lot of the muscle breakdown. All you really want is that concentric work mainly, right? So doing things like hitting the bag, you know, but doing it in specific intervals.
Right. And so since we're talking about some of Joel Jamison's methods, I've noticed that you're a big proponent of Joel's BioForce HRV system recently. Can we just go into a little bit more detail about autonomic nervous system function and how you guys monitor and optimize your training and nutrition protocols based on things like heart rate variability?
Yeah, absolutely. So like we discussed before, we do a waking heart rate variability. So that's, for me, the best time to take it, because you're not affected yet by like getting out of bed and doing things. So a lot of the guys that we get, because they only do anaerobic training, because they're all scared shitless of aerobics, they're all scared shitless of carbs. So we have to completely reprogram their thinking. I've had guys that, you know, they've been strength coaches for 5 years. They come to me and their heart rate's 85 when they wake up. That's ridiculous.
That's,
they feel
very
like
high.
That's very high. Like, even resting heart rate, you know, you look at resting heart rate, maybe 65. Your waking heart rate really should be in the low to mid 50s, in my opinion, if you're in really good, if you're really balanced. So when we look at that, we say, okay, your heart rate's too high. That shows that you are epinephrine and norepinephrine dominant, you're sympathetic dominant. You need to be parasympathetic dominant. Again, that sympathetic system is primarily there to get you out of danger. So if it's keyed up all the time, your body thinks you're jacked up all the time, you're not going to get the benefits of the parasympathetic system, which is rest and digest. So a lot of these guys, they complain about gut issues. They've got diarrhea, constipation, bloating. They've got tons of – they can't eat anything because they've got food intolerances, right? All of this stuff is related to stress. And what's gnarly is that the brain has that direct link to the gut, and it can stimulate permeability in the gut because of stress. You don't really need cortisol to make that happen. Your brain can make that happen,
so
right?
So I was going to say, on the food intolerance part, is that obviously, is there a strong correlation between stress and, you know, being, have a predisposition to food intolerances or even exacerbating them?
Absolutely. And the majority of food intolerances, so you look at a food allergy versus a food intolerance. A food allergy is something like somebody's got a peanut allergy and they eat a peanut and they fucking go into anaphylactic shock, right? Yeah. When you look at a food intolerance, the majority of those are temporary things that have happened because you're not mitigating your stress. So when you're stressed out, you have the tight junctions in the cells in your gut lining. They start to get loose. Those tight junctions are only supposed to let certain size particles into your bloodstream. Well, when they get loose, then you get food that is only partially digested. It's not completely broken down. That'll make its way into your hepatic portal. You'll have bacteria and viruses, it allows those to permeate through. So you think of that that lining inside of your GI tract, that's the skin for the inside of your body. And what does skin do? Skin keeps things out that's not supposed to be in there, right? So when you start allowing that stuff in there, around 80% of your immune system is located in and around the gut. So that creates a hypersensitive immune system, and you basically get what I call an autoimmune disease towards food. So then every time let's say you had a stressful event and you're eating a lot of chicken and now you're getting reactions to chicken, you're going to have to get off of chicken for a while and switch to something else and do an elimination diet. But you're never going to get better if you don't calm that stress response down. For most people, that means not training as much and working on your least mode. And you can take like glutamine's important, but you can take all the glutamine you want. If you don't take care of your head and your stress management, you're never going to fix your stomach.
So one of the things that we see fight athletes going through that is incredibly stressful is weight cut. So whether people are participating or competing in an event where there's a same-day weigh-in, so let's say 5 minutes before your event or your first fight, you weigh in, you go to the bullpen, you wait, or a 24-hour weigh-in where you go through that process of of cutting down and then building back up in time for fight time. Do you have any comments or any observations around mistakes that people make going through that cutting process?
Yeah, for one thing, don't get fat in your off season. You know, that's part of it is just the simple fact that fighters let themselves go, and they think that if they're heavier, they're going to train better, but that's simply not the case. You know, if you're fighting at 155, there's no reason for you to be 178, you know, leading into 4 months out from your show or from your fight. And if you are, you need to start cutting that down, especially if you have a same day weigh-in. You simply just don't have enough time to put water back in your body, and that's super important. Where does that weight come from? They're cutting shit tons of water. Okay, when you cut shit tons of water and you get dehydrated, your performance goes down. You gas out much faster. You need water to make more energy, right? You need, so it's asinine for them to think that they need to be 15, 16 kilos heavier when they're, you know, entering that their prep. And that's simply not the case. They'd be better off if they slowly lean themselves out and stay at just a few kilos above their fighting weight.
So then it's a really minimal water loss for the actual competition or performance.
Right. And if it's a 24-hour weigh-in, that's pretty easy. You know, I like what's his name? Mike Dolce. Mm-hmm. I really like his when I was powerlifting, it was nothing for me to do, you know, 12, 13 kilos in 24 hours on a weight cut and then blow back up the next day for my powerlifting. But that's a whole different thing. That's an all-day event. I'm doing 9 reps total all fucking day. I'm not going in there and trying to fight somebody for 5 minutes, right? So it's a bit different ordeal. We used to use things like I would cut carbs out about 5 days out. I would cut my water down a little bit. I would sit in the sauna, take a laxative, and take a massive shit. You know, I'd usually do it. So you simply, I know fighters do it, but it's not the right thing to do because you end up not being as crisp. You end up getting hurt, your timing's off, you can't think, you have no energy. So it's much better for them to do it more slowly. With Mike, he has that his hot tub protocol, his hot tub step protocol. And I actually have tried it a bit the last couple of weeks just to see how well it works. And I've got my own protocol because I don't have a hot tub of basically what I do in the bathtub. And I can pull off about 2 to 3 kilos in about 45 minutes sitting in a hot bathtub. So...
And what does that entail?
So with his step one, you basically get in a hot tub up to your neck and you spend some time in there. And then, you know, you say like 5-6 minutes, then you go up to chest height for 5 or 6 minutes. Then you go up to waist height and then you sit on the edge with your feet in the water. And then you can repeat that as much as you can. With mine, since I don't have we've got a fairly decent sized tub, I'll go down to my neck, basically Netflix and chill and get under the water. In as hot a water as I can handle, and I'll stay there for 5 or 6 minutes, and then I'll go up to where I'm just sitting in the water, and it's nothing for me to pull off 3 kilos in, you know, 30, 40 minutes, sometimes four and a half.
And you follow that with wrapping yourself in towels or lots of hoodies and, you know?
Nah, I haven't yet because I'm just doing it basically to experiment because now that I'm in Brisbane, I have a lot of friends that powerlift, and they're always asking for advice, and so I'm working on – I never do anything with anybody that I haven't actually done myself. So now I'm actually just kind of playing with this stuff, and it's a bit silly. But on Saturday is my birthday, and I want to hit a double body weight deadlift, and so I'm trying to get my body weight down to 100 kilos and pull like 210 or something. So I'm practicing this because the night before in the morning of, I'm going to get in the bathtub and try to shred some water off and kind of cheat the system a little bit.
Nice. What body weight are you sitting at the moment?
What's that body weight?
Yeah.
Around 104 to 106.
Nice.
Yeah, and I haven't really trained. I haven't had I think right now has been my longest training program I've had in 4 years.
You've been running.
6 weeks. So I had Phil Lerney challenged me to deadlifting, so I have to pull 200. Troy challenged me to a 5K, so I'm trying to run a sub 25 minute 5K while I'm also trying to do a 200 kilo or 210 kilo deadlift. So I'm training for both of these at the same time while trying to diet. So it's pretty rough.
Hybrid athlete.
Yeah, I really like Alex Vieta's hybrid athlete stuff, and you know, really, I think that's the way of the future, man, where the strength conditioning industry is getting to the point where we know how to do all of it at the same time if you're patient.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just putting all the pieces together the right way, right?
Exactly. And understanding that you can get really strong doing 10 sets in a workout. You don't have to do 30, right?
Yeah.
Like I've literally put on 60 kilos on my deadlift in the last 4 weeks.
Wow.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's like half of what I lift.
Like, see, I hadn't been training in a long time. I went and I pulled 150 and that was a bit of a struggle. I've had some injuries in my upper back where I'm kind of gun shy and I'm pulling around 200 to 205 now. So
that's huge.
Yeah.
Well, good luck for your birthday, that double body weight pull.
Yeah, hopefully I don't snap something in my back again.
You'll get it. So let's just change directions for a moment. Since one of your strong suits is picking the right supplementation protocols, have you got any hacks or supplement stacks that may benefit fighters with, you know, with the performance, recovery, or cognitive function?
Yeah, so like stated earlier, lactate is a big deal. So some of the things we'll give, we find that guys that are overly producing lactate are typically deficient in vitamin B1 and thiamine. So we'll typically give them a little bit of benfothiamine, which is a fat-soluble B1, which is something I got from Michael McAvoy from Metabolic Healing. Works really, really well, around 500 milligrams twice a day. We also use a lot of things, like we use the beta-alanine. We use creatine a lot. For the mental game and also for more energy production. Something else that's of interest, and this is not something I recommend people do, you really need to know about methylation, but in order to make the backbone for ATP, which is your body's energy currency, you have to have good methylation pathways, right? So adding in a little bit of methylated folate and or making sure you're eating a lot of good leafy greens, so a lot of cooked spinach, kale, stuff like that. And, you know, we try to use as much food nutrition as we can, and then we utilize supplementation on top of that. So we look at energy production, and we look at dampening inflammation. Okay, so what we use for that is we'll use berberine. We'll also use things like bergamot extract. We'll use things like curcumin. We use a lot of curcumin, a lot of boswellian.
Okay. I love the approach to try and address all the needs with whole foods first, good quality whole foods first, and then supplementation as needed. I think that's fantastic. But tell us, what are your thoughts on nootropics?
I like nootropics. It just depends, you know, it depends which ones you're talking about and which country you're in, because the legality of those are starting to get a bit shifty. Like in America, they're pretty – you know, it's pretty open. I know the UK just passed some legislation a while back, a few months ago, regarding the importation and selling of nootropics. So I think they're banned there now. So I don't typically use them with people a lot, depending, like if you're talking about like the racetams and things like that, we don't really use those a lot with people just because you never know how they're going to react to them. So we will use a lot of acetyl-L-carnitine, acetyl-L-tyrosine. We use a lot of choline, alpha-GPC, huperzine, stuff like that. So I like to use things that are complementary to each other. Like we're really big on Thorne Research. We like their supplements. And I use a lot of neurochondria. So we like the Lehman Brain Stack that I came up with was neurochondria, Memoractive, and resveratrol, which basically takes care of energy production in the brain and blood flow to the brain and memory. So I'm telling you, when I'm taking that stack, I swear to God, I can hear people thinking.
I'm going to need to re-listen to this podcast just to write down all those names and half those words. Most of those words were new to me.
Well, so like, you know, I'm really big into the energy creation of energy and things like that and anti-aging. So when you look at energy creation in the brain, your brain will chew up at minimum about, if you're dumb, your brain will chew up about 25% of your resting metabolic rate. If you're studying like Zoe and I do and our guy Isaac, we're always studying, we're always writing, we're always coming up with things. Your brain's going to chew through energy a lot faster. So it makes sense to give your body nutrients that is going to force your brain cells to make energy faster, right? So that's kind of the basis of the Lehman brain stack.
That's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that.
You bet.
So over the time that we've spent together, there's been a lot of information that we've covered. So have you got any recommendations around books or further reading for either for us or for any of our listeners who might want to delve into some more detail about any of the stuff we've talked about?
Yeah, you know, Joel Jameson's site is always a good one. His www.8weeksout.com. I think for if people that want to start learning about training, Super Training by Mel Siff, that's a classic that you have to read, and it's one of those books you read 800 times before you figure it out. Also, Cracking the Metabolic Code by James LaValle.
That's huge.
That's huge, and you got to read that like 10 times before you figure that out. The first book of training I ever had was Poliquin Principles by Charles Poliquin. So that was the one that started it all for me, and I highly recommend that. Classic. That and his Modern Methods of Strength Training is also excellent. And then one that I've gotten into lately by James Smith is called The Governing Dynamics of Coaching. And that's right along there with Super Training. It's very highly technical, and it's one of those you read a page about 50 times before you finally figure out what he's trying to say. And then obviously there's our seminars. Our seminars are always good.
Or consultations.
Consultations.
Oh, fantastic. Shameless plug.
Shameless plug.
Wim Hof too. We've gotten big into the breathing. So we're getting into, I got into Wim Hof stuff, which was awesome for resetting autonomic tone. And now we've started modifying some of his stuff and adding in other stuff from yoga. And I'm working on like free diving breathing, because what I found was all of my friends at free dive, they're all shredded all the time. Doesn't matter what they eat. They're all shredded. And you need oxygen to create energy. You need oxygen to keep your acid-base balance correct, so your body's not constantly fighting acid. And most of these guys, they're always super chill, super calm, and shredded. So we kind of got into that, and I find that the more you learn how to breathe and utilize oxygen, the easier it is to stay lean, and the easier it is to be able to eat your lollies or your Tim Tams without getting fat. So that's always... That's a bonus for me.
Yes, that's a bonus for me. I was going to say, Hicks and Gracie, as they call it, and spelled with an R, but one of the OG legends of the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu scene, he says that if you can control your breath, you can control your life.
100%. 100%. I've got a book called Breathology that I'm starting to read, and it's by a really famous free diver, and it's got a lot of philosophical stuff in there about how breathing can completely transform your life. And when people get stressed out, they stop breathing normally. They start breathing with their chest, and they don't use all of their lungs. So.
I think it's also worth noting in that regard that we actually have a lot more control over ourselves than we think we do, not just in regards to breathing, but also in regards to lifestyle and, like, the epigenetics, so, like, your DNA and all that sort of stuff. Like, we have a lot more say in how our body responds to stuff than most people realize.
And that's something that Wim Hof is – they're doing research on him, on how he's able to control his immune system, how he's able to keep his core body temperature elevated even though he's submerged in ice for over an hour, right? How he can run through the desert, run a marathon without drinking any water.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's so strange because, I mean, there's no scientific explanation for what's going on. It seems like he's willing it to be so.
Exactly, and it's all part of that breathing. And, you know, he may not be right about all the stuff, and that's typically how it works. We find a method that works. Now we have to figure out why it works, and that's the goal of science, is to prove or disprove stuff, and then to figure out the why something works. And it's pretty amazing that for a long time we didn't think that we had any control of our autonomic nervous system. But what he's shown is you absolutely have control, but you have, just like anything else, you have to practice and you have to work on it. And I can tell you right now, as I'm trying to develop these new breathing techniques that we use in our practice, you put on a heart rate monitor, like a BioForce, or put on a Polar H7 or what have you, that measures your heart rate variability, put it on the BioForce app, or put it on Elite HRV, or put it on SweetBeat, or whatever app you use, practice your breathing and watch what happens to your heart rate variability. And what I'll typically do is to teach somebody this, I'll start doing some hyperventilation training, and I can completely crash their HRV, And then so their sympathetic system is getting ramped all crazy. And then I've got techniques to bring them back out of that and actually jump their HRV 10 or 15 points above where they started when they first started the practice.
So have you seen in the hard data in terms of your own personal experience from implementing the Wim Hof methods, have you noticed that, you know, you've been able to consistently drop your HRV or your HR?
100%. Like when I first started messing around with it, my heart rate was in the mid-70s. Like, after I left Pollokin Group, it was a very stressful time for me the year after that. And, you know, I was having a hard time controlling my stress, and it was nuts. So I started measuring my HRV. My HRV was around 48 to 52, and my waking heart rate would be anywhere from 75 to 80. I started using Joel Jameson's stuff and started doing different types of techniques for aerobic work. I cut my training down a little bit and started doing stretching and aerobics. That helped a lot. But once I started doing the Wim Hof breathing, within a week, my HRV was 81 and my heart rate was 52.
And Luke's like super analytical. Like, he gets obsessed about stuff. So when he's like learning about something or looking into something, for instance, if he's tracking his blood sugar or his ketones or anything like that, he'll do something and then he'll retest, and then he'll do something and he'll retest, and he'll do something and he'll retest. And he's literally spending the day just testing to see how things change and how he responds to different things. And he just gets this massive amount of information just from all the testing he's doing on himself and me and others.
You guys should see my fingertips right now, because I draw blood from my fingertips probably 15 times a day.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And I can barely get blood out of my fingers now. I'm gonna have to start like stabbing my toes.
Oh, you guys, I'm looking at the time here. We're at a 90-minute interview so far. So,
that went by.
It did. Went
too
by
much
quick.
Fun.
We could sit here talking all night, I reckon, but we probably should start to wrap things up. So, for Luke and Zoe, Muscle Nerds, what have you guys got planned for 2017?
Learn how to run a business.
Yeah. It's on our back end, but on our front end.
We've got, you know, refining level one and two a little bit more, starting to ride a level three and a test, because we're going to have a test. You have to come to level one and two, then you have to test to be able to go to level three. And that's where things are going to get really serious. We've got a lot of methods and techniques we're doing. We hired on Isaac to start growing that online business, our online training, which we do online training, group training, and one-on-one stuff.
We've got a few seminars planned as well. So we're obviously next month we're in Singapore and Hong Kong. Then we've got Perth in April, which is our last level one and two that we're holding in Australia this year. And then we're doing a joint seminar with Eugene Teo, the body mechanic. So we're doing a bodybuilding and physique seminar with him in Melbourne, Perth, and Brisbane.
And when's that?
Huh?
We're doing the one in May. What's that?
Yeah, that's in May, is it?
No, we've got it. Well, yeah.
There's one in June, one in July, one in May. Yeah, there is one in May. We're doing one in New Zealand, which is a really interesting one. It's called When It's Not About the Food. So that's addressing the whole mental and psychological issues around why people self-sabotage. And so, like, you could write the perfect plan, exercise and nutrition for your client, but as soon as they start getting results, they just self-sabotage and go back to where they were. Usually there's an underlying issue with that. So we're teaming up with a counselor in New Zealand, and we're holding a two-day seminar there in May.
So she's going to teach trainers what to look for and what is in their pay grade to talk to their clients about, and when to refer out, and what it all means, and how to get them over these mental blocks and get them moving again. So.
Yeah, so that's going to be a really good one.
Yeah.
And then in August, we're back over to the Northern Hemisphere. So we do Montreal, Texas, London.
Yeah, and then I've got one that I'm coming up with. I've had a lot of people ask how it is that we can absorb and recall and remember so much information. And so I think we're going to write a seminar on learning how to learn and talk about the biochemistry of memorizing stuff and retrieval, and teach people how to actually learn, because that's part of the problem with people going to seminars. Like, our seminar is extremely heavy with information.
It's super
intense, and I've dialed it back a little bit because people just couldn't absorb all of it. So what we want to do is teach people how to actually learn, and then how to not to memorize things, but how to do active recall and how to apply it to their clients and to their lives, which is vastly different than just going to a seminar and writing notes.
And it's funny because when you actually start to learn stuff and understand it, it's not so much about memory as it is understanding. It's, you don't have to just remember all these random facts. You actually have, you know, things start to have links and you start to understand. So it's easy to be able to recall information. And so,
and you have to know how to apply it. That's the thing. How do I apply it?
So it's more about internalizing the concept as opposed to, you know, memorizing all the little finer details that comprise the greater concept that you can recall and execute as you need and apply it to the specific situation.
Absolutely. And, you know, the industry already has enough know-it-alls that they repeat things they hear and they have absolutely no idea what the fuck they're talking about.
Yeah, brainless mantras.
Right. We need more people that actually talk about things that they know about and know how to use instead of just throwing out big words to try to sound smart.
It's another thing I teach Luke when he was writing level one is because I remember when I walked away from Biosignature, I was like, I felt more dumb than I did before I went in. I was just like, I don't understand this near enough to be comfortable to use it. So there's no point in me telling someone, oh, you've got estrogen dominance, when I can't even explain what estrogen dominance is or how it happens or how the supplements are actually going to help counteract that and all that sort of stuff. So I said, like, we need to give stuff that's applicable instantly so they understand and they can go away and the next day they can use it because that's where the value is.
Absolutely. And that's a common complaint about a lot of the early Biosignature courses, that they were just too overwhelming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and they're teaching a lot of stuff that has absolutely no relevance on what trainers do.
Like, and you can't learn hormones in 3 days.
No. And what we teach in our seminars is, you don't really have a lot of control over that stuff anyways, especially not as a trainer, but what you have a lot of control over is teaching people how to reduce and manage stress, which is why all their hormones are fucked anyways.
Yeah. All right, you guys, we better leave it there. Now, of course, we're going to post some links on how our listeners can get in touch with you guys, but why don't you just give us the rundown right now on how people can reach out?
Yeah, you can get us online at musclenerds.net. You can get us email as info@musclenerds.net. We're also on Facebook. We've got that. And
which is just Muscle Nerds.
Muscle Nerds. And then if you want to give us a phone call, it's 0402-792-864.
Wow. Mobile number. Love that.
Give him a call in the middle of the night.
Don't call me in the middle of the night, asshole. But you can call if you ever want to say,
be a repeat offender.
Give me sweet nothings in my ear and that type of thing.
Oh, Luke, you know I will.
Great phone voice, too.
I'll promise that I won't.
Yeah. No, that's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us such a huge amount of valuable information that our listeners will, no doubt take heaps from. From Brenton, Steve, myself, thank you so much for joining us on the Unknown Strength Podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you guys.
All right, see ya.
See you guys.